diagnostic systems in high-burden countries. Thank you all for coming. And I think we have a very good presentations today about some important work that's been going on in the countries. We're going to start out with a speaker, Dr. Anandate. I'm sorry, I should have introduced myself. I'm Linda Parsons. I'm from the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta, Georgia, in the Division of Global AIDS International Lab Branch. And I will let my co-moderator introduce himself here.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Gerrit Kutsir. I'm the head of the National TB Reference Laboratory in Johannesburg, South Africa.
So our sessions today will begin with a speaker, Dr. Anandate from the Centers for Disease Control, the Global AIDS Program, but a focused on laboratory, but actually part of the TB HIV program staff, who will give us a review on significance of an accurate and responsive TB lab system for enhanced TB control.
Thanks, Linda. Good afternoon, everyone. As Linda said, I'm not a lab expert, mainly from the program side. So Linda asked me to give this presentation on significance of accurate and responsive TB lab systems for enhanced TB control. And I was when I was preparing my presentation, I started thinking, and I said, duh, I mean, it's given. I mean, how can you proceed without labs being involved in TB control? But then from program side, I started thinking, what if we did not have lab diagnostics? And I found this slide I borrowed from Find Diagnostic very useful, thinking about this. Imagine a scenario we do not have access to lab diagnostic. What can happen? One, we will not be able to identify people. So we do not put people on treatment. So it can have implications. Basically, the person will continue with his illness, ultimately maybe the eventually die. From public health standpoint, we are leaving that person in the community with active TB, so he's going to transmit the disease to other people, so we have continued transmission. And overall impact, it's going to 1 to 2, 2 to 4, and then it multiplies exponentially, and it is going to grow incidence and prevalence of TB in the community, and obviously increasing the burden of disease. Other scenario, lack of diagnostic, but then we come up with innovative ways, maybe approach is syndromic approach, and then we decide to treat people based on syndromic approach. As a result, we might miss some people, or we might treat people who do not have disease, so over-treatment. What can happen is we can allocate resources and results in the waste of resources, and obviously development of drug resistance. As a result, overall impact, misallocation of resources, and increasing the difficulty in control of disease with the added challenge of MDR and XDR-TB. So bottom line, if you cannot diagnose it, you cannot possibly treat or control it. So then I started thinking, okay, what's the role of lab in TB control? So I started putting out bullets. So first of all, obviously, the labs are very important in terms of diagnosing all cases, whether it is smear positive, smear negative, extrapulmonary. And the challenge which still remains a big challenge is pediatric TB. Second important aspect, monitor patient response to treatment. As the patients are diagnosed and put on treatment, receiving DOT to monitor the patient response, whether patient are responding to the treatment by periodic sputum examinations or in some countries maybe culture examinations. And then thirdly, participate in the surveillance. So notification of diseases, TB, in terms of notification as well as prevalence of the disease. And importantly, drug resistance cases, how many drug resistance we have, and then also monitor the trends of drug resistance. And then once you have the diagnosis, maybe also the labs have important critical role to play in terms of putting people on treatment, identifying and selecting appropriate drugs for these MDR-TB cases, and also support operational research, and then guide policy and development and changes. The best example recently, the WHO guidance changing from 3-sputum to 2-sputum, and that's basically contribution of lab. So where are we in terms of TB control? Obviously, that was the role of the labs. We still have treatment, advocacy, and all these things put together, and we need to do progress. This is from the Global TB Report 2008. If you see all TB cases, we are only diagnosing half of the new TB cases in 2006. Same with smear positive cases. When it comes to MDR, estimated 700,000 1,000 new new MDR cases in 2006, we are identifying only 5%, or just a little more, 6%, 46,000 of those diseases. So we have all these labs. We know what the lab's role is, and then treatment and other aspects. But then something is missing because we are not achieving what we started our path for. So what's the missing link? So first of all, poor coordination between the program and the labs. More often, I mean, labs usually lie under the program, but then there is a disconnect. When it is planning, the lab folks are not involved in planning for the development or strengthening of the labs. It seems to be improving over the period of last few years, but we still need to do better. Poor allocation of funds for lab strengthening. Again, lack of involvement of the lab people when it comes to, it is just handled by the program people without talking or engaging lab personnel. By and large, still in high burden countries, it is still the microscopy-based case detection. And we know, I mean, it is not the best diagnostic, 125-year-old. Sensitivity less than 60% with HIV, it is much lesser. And then in programmatic conditions, you can imagine, I'm sure you have program-level experience. I remember I worked in India with WHO on TB program, going to field and talking to lab technicians. And then this was an interesting instance where people giving results based on just looking at the slides outside the window. Then inadequate access to smear microscopy. I attended a session this morning, Dr. Paramshivam from FIND, and I was intrigued. And then this is mentioned in the World TB Report 2008. The norm for smear microscopy center is 1 per 100,000. Even in 22 high-burden countries, there are many countries who do not have this requirement met. So we have far ways to go, even in terms of access to smear microscopy. In terms of quality assurance, either there are non-existence or poorly implemented. There are many countries, even high-burden countries, which do not have all the labs which are included under the quality assurance program. And then what it means by including labs under quality assurance programs, we do not know, because there are maybe no quality indicators and how to monitor quality assurance. And lastly, difficulty in implementation and poor quality of culture and DST services. Again, out of these 22 high-burden countries, there are still countries who do not have a national reference lab. They do not have a culture or DST facilities. They still rely on the supranational labs to do the cultures and drug sensitivities. There are countries which have capacity to do the culture and drug sensitivity, but there are no clear policies. Who gets the culture and drug sensitivity? And even if there are policies, those are not translated into actions. The field level people do not know who actually can get culture drug sensitivity. What is the mechanism to transport specimens? What is the mechanism to get the results? Another missing link. To add to all this, we have this challenge of HIV. There was an interesting quote Linda was mentioning at some meeting. Activists came up with this theme, living with HIV, dying of TB. So HIV is a big problem, HIV-associated TB. Now with increasing HIV-TB activities on the HIV side, we are promoting intensified TB case finding. And we are promoting, okay, each and every encounter with HIV patients, we need to be screening for TB. And then out of that, you get TB suspects. So we have millions of people living with HIV. Just giving an example, there are currently 3 million people put on ART, and then almost 20% incidence of TB among those patients. So imagine, and then for every case, there are 3 to 4 suspects, and you need to do 2 to 3 sputum specimens. If you actually calculate this, if we had to do first sputum for all these 3 million people, it comes to millions of smear in a year. Another important challenge is HIV services. We started with the top level, regional level, district level. Now we are saturated there. And if we have to achieve universal access to HIV prevention, care, and treatment, we need to go decentralized, go down to the primary health centers. And we have been working with the WHO on this operations manual, which is basically to decentralize these HIV care prevention services to the primary health center. What it is doing is that means you are increasing the number of outlets where these HIV-infected patients are going to access services. And then that's where the TB screening or symptom screening or whatever is going to happen. And whoever has the TB suspects, they are going to need to go to this DB diagnostic services. So we are increasing demand. And then we do not really have mechanism how to send these patients or transport sputums and how to get back the results. And lastly, HIV-associated TB, we all know that it is atypical TB. It is smear negative and extrapulmonary TB, so it is challenging to diagnose. And then even though we are making good progress, the reality of this time is smear microscopy is the norm, and then we are going slowly into culture and new innovative diagnostics. But it is still going to be a challenge. How do we diagnose smear negative and extrapulmonary and TB in HIV-infected people? So what can be the response, lab diagnostic response to HIV challenge? First of all, as I said, even if we are talking about new diagnostic, today it's the smear microscopy. So decentralized smear microscopy, get those norms, whatever more number of microscopy centers need to be established in all these countries. There are some countries which have enough labs in country, but then the quality of those labs, as I mentioned some time back, are questionable. So also there needs to be an emphasis, how can we improve the quality of existing smear microscopy? I know there have been a lot of progress, maybe the concentration methods and LED microscopes using fluorescent microscopy in high volume settings, et cetera. But that may be a possible solution. Improving turnaround time for lab results for quick decision making. This is another challenge with HIV infected. If they are critically ill, it is really important to get those results back in time so that we can take appropriate action and start the people on treatment. Because there are instances when you go out to the field that patient's sputum is sent for maybe diagnostics cultures, and then by the time results come back, patient is already dead. So that's another challenge. So maybe we need to improve turnaround time. There have been discussion and arguments, well, even with liquid culture, we are not really going to increase because it still takes 2 weeks. I think we are not even using the microscopy properly. So that argument, I mean, we need to take a stepwise approach. And then ultimately we will be at a place, maybe we have a point of care rapid diagnostic tool to improve care of patient living with HIV. I think that's really a dream. If we can have that, especially for smear negative cases, and if point of care, we can have a diagnostic and then take decisions on starting the patients on appropriate treatment as soon as possible. MDR-XDR is another challenge. As we know, MDR and XDR cases have been on the rise. And then in 2006, out of 700,000, we just identified only 6% of the cases. So there is definitely a need to conduct drug resistance surveys and routine monitoring, trying to find out how much is the burden of MDR-TB, and then monitor trends as we implement this program, which direction the MDR epidemic is going. Second-line drugs are now available, and then growing number of countries which are implementing DOTS plus strategies. We cannot imagine managing MDR patients without having good lab infrastructure and lab capacity. So, and then lastly, MDR and XDR-TBs, there is a high fatality rate in these patients. So it is really prudent that we have rapid diagnostics which can help us take appropriate and fast action so that we can save these lives. So again, how can we respond to this? Again, improve availability and quality of culture and drug susceptibility testing. Maybe we don't have to jump to liquid cultures immediately. I mean, some countries even don't have solid cultures. So maybe start with solid cultures, go to liquid cultures. Now there has been a lot of midget establishments in all these countries. They also need to keep in mind that there is an identification part of it, even though I'm not a lab person. But then some countries, that part is missing. Everyone is going midget, but then and then they are sharing those results with the clinicians. But then they are missing that identification piece. So that also needs to be kept in mind. As I said, this DOTS plus strategy, green light committee, increasingly available. And then we have the second line testing only available at the supranational lab. And then these limited supranational labs, how many countries and how many needs they can fulfill, that remains a question. So we have to slowly start building capacity in country so they can look at so that the national reference labs can have capacity to do this second line testing in country. Again, rapid diagnostic tests, as I said, will be very useful and important for MDR-XDR cases. And then we have this LineProbe assay, which was approved by WHO for use under certain conditions. So maybe we can think about rolling those out in appropriate way. And then lastly, again, a point of care rapid diagnostics test. It would be really useful. I was looking at this presentation of the thin agar layer color test. Very, very encouraging. And then I'm sure there are more tests in the pipeline. So to achieve all this TB control, this is the top stop TB strategy to reach 2015 Millennium Development Goals. And I have highlighted the where the labs fits in. So these are six broadings, but you can see almost each one of them, lab is a critical component, whether it's case detection with quality assured bacteriology or addressing MDR, TB, XDR, TB, TB, HIV, system development. I mean, this conference is about health system development. I'm not going to talk about that. But then obviously, as in the plenary, Dr. Ambassador Mark Dibble said, even disease-specific programs are building health systems. So definitely TB has a role. Public-private partnership, again, important, and I can give you an example from India. And then I was involved in this rollout of DOT strategy in India, and then private sector in India is pretty strong. 70% of the healthcare is provided by the private sector. So even if you have this access, 100% accessibility of DOTs throughout the country, you possibly cannot think about TB control unless you involve private sector. And then lastly, research to develop new diagnostics, which I'm happy to say that there is much progress being made. Again, this is from STOP-EG. To achieve all these 2015 Millennium Development Goals, this is what we need. Global capacity to do 120 million smears, 60 million cultures, and 6 million drug sensitivity testings. And this is going to require establishment of a network of hundreds of thousands of smear microscopy labs, and then maybe intermediate-level specialized labs which can do more advanced tests, and then also hundreds of national reference labs and strengthening them. And then this will require $1 billion U.S. dollars investment. I'm sure Global Fund, PEPFAR, and other funders, but we are all aware of the current economic situation. So we hope that these funds will come along and we will be able to make progress. But then there are other critical elements, because money is not everything. You have money, you have equipment, you cannot think that you achieved the goal of strengthening lab system. There are other critical elements in terms of lab strengthening and then contributing to the TB control. First, again, access and coverage. We talked about it some time back. We need to have a network of labs, and then there needs to be a national strategic plan, maybe TB-specific, which also merges into the other disease-specific strategic plan, and see how can we establish, because you cannot just, we need a few hundred labs, okay, tomorrow we will just establish. We need to look at the access of services, where strategically pick and choose places where we need to establish these microscopy centers. And then other diseases, HIV, malaria, they are also doing this. So we do not need to invest, like we do not need to reinvent the wheel. Maybe those labs have already been upgraded. We just need to make sure, make entry point and make sure that the microscopy services are available. Even with we have money, one thing we cannot buy is human resources. In all the programs, this is a critical challenge we are facing. How do we tackle this? Again, going back to India, because I have experience working in India with TB control program. We had this problem. We developed hundreds of, I think if I remember correctly, 700-something microscopy centers. And then we had issues finding this lab technician. So we actually used the sweepers who were working in, because most of the time lab technician was just reading the slides. It was the sweeper who was preparing the smears. So we actually started using those people, and then to surprise, and then through quality assurance, performance was better. I'm not saying that we can start using those as lab technicians, but we can use them as microscopists. Also, at various level, you need managers who can manage these labs. Again, in resource-limited setting, those people are hard to come by. And then as we make this progress, there is going to be a lot of technical assistance required, how to strengthen these labs. So also, we need people for that. System for referral and reporting. So we have decentralized network. We have human resources available doing the microscopy. But then not every health facility is going to have each diagnostic test available. If it is smear microscopy, there might be a need to transport specimens of sputum from one level to another. If it is culture, we might have to transport sputum from the peripheral level to the intermediate or higher level. So there needs to be a mechanism. Most of the times, clinicians are not aware how does it go, and then most of the times they do not hear back from the labs what happened to the results, and then it discourages people from submitting this. Now, we don't have to reinvent the wheel again. I can give example of early infant diagnosis. There have been a lot of progress done in that, and then there are one or two labs doing actually the test, but then there is a network already established in many of these countries where these dried blood spots are transported from the periphery to these labs which conduct, and then it is turnaround. It is usually within 24 to 48 hours, so remarkable. So we need to tap these resources so we can maybe think about, again, transportation requirements might be different for dried blood spot versus sputum, but then we can exploit what's already out there. Again, quality assurance program, critical. We have networks, microscopy networks, but if they are not quality assured, then we have a problem, because they are important not only from terms of strengthening the lab networks, but also improving the diagnosis. And I think I'll go beyond that. It is also important to have this quality labs, quality assurance, so that we build confidence in the clinicians so they can continue to use the lab services. Otherwise, there will be a point if you clinicians stop having faith in their labs, they will just start doing empiric treatments. So, and then lastly, biosafety. I mean, we are talking about whether smear microscopy or cultures, then at culture level, there's BSL-3, BSL-4, and so biosafety is also a critical issue, because we cannot just keep advancing with the labs and then forget about threat to the health workers which are actually doing this test. So that is also critical. So these are some of the critical elements which we need to think when we are approaching this lab strengthening, and then which will contribute to the TB control. So I think it is a, if you think about it, it's a mammoth task. In terms of the resources required and then how do we approach. Because even if we say we need so many labs, it's not easy. It's not possible to do it overnight. But I think we have come a long way over a period of 125 years from smear microscopy and then liquid solid culture, liquid culture, and we have this line probe assay and then excellent promising new tests coming along. So I think I would like to end with quote, I would like to take you back to this slide which we started with. So if any of these critical elements is missing, we can go back to this lack of diagnosis, which can put us into this vicious cycle, and then it can lead us to more challenges in terms of TB control. But I think, as I said, we have come a long way from smear microscopy, and then there are many new techniques on the horizon. And then I would like to end with a quote from Tom Frieden. I'm sure many of you know Dr. Tom Frieden, who was the pioneer of Indian TB program implementation, and he's New York City commissioner now. And he always used to say, irrational optimism is the prerequisite for success. So I'm sure we can do it. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Anand. One of our speakers was not able to make it today, Professor Dosso from Cote d'Ivoire. So are there one or two questions for Dr. Date at this time? We will also have a discussion at the end of the all of the speakers. All right. We will now move to we've heard a lot about the challenges and what the TB control program and likewise moving to care of the patient requires from the laboratory. So now we will hear from results from Kenya, Dr. Anjan Van Hoog, on building and implementing TB lab capacity for diagnostics, vaccine trials, and surveillance in Western Kenya. Anja?
Okay, thank you. Good afternoon. Thank you for inviting me to speak. I would like to share with you our experiences in our efforts to establish TB laboratory capacity in Kisumu, Western Kenya. And like the previous speaker, also I am not a laboratory expert, but I will more talk about the process of getting the laboratory. So where is the laboratory that I'm talking about? It's at the CEMRI CDC program, or the CEMRI CDC Field Research Station in Kisumu. And that's a collaboration between the Kenya Medical Research Institute, Center for Global Health Research, and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention from the USA. And it started in the 70s with entomology and then expanded with malaria, epidemiology and other studies, HIV research work, demographic surveillance, and the youngest child in the family is also tuberculosis epidemiology. And our TB work is a collaboration between CEMRI, the different centers, also the Center for Respiratory Diseases Research, CDC, the University of Amsterdam, and a number of other collaborators listed on the slide. And for those of you who don't know the area, Kenya is in East Africa, and Kisumu is on the shore of Lake Victoria. And this slide shows an area where a lot of the studies done at the center are conducted. And to go back to that, the area around the lake, Nyanza province, is an area with the highest HIV prevalence, TB prevalence, malaria, and other diseases in Kenya. So what did we have in mind when we established the laboratory? It was initiated to support the tuberculosis epidemiology studies. And our main objective is to establish a safe and high-quality mycobacterial laboratory that is able to meet our current and future research needs and also hopefully other programmatic needs. And we wanted to establish it within an already existing laboratory building. And some parts of that are shown on the pictures on the campus of the center is already a very nice laboratory built with laboratories for HIV, malaria, and respiratory diseases, but there was no TB laboratory. But the space had already like furniture and things like that in place. And eventually we would like to have the laboratory accredited. So we're developing the laboratory in phases. And the first step is to the first step was to support a local tuberculosis prevalence survey. In this study, we wanted to enroll about 20,000 participants. So we wanted a laboratory that could handle 40,000 sputum samples in about a year, or in the end, it became more like 1.5 years, and do on those samples sputum concentration, fluorescence microscopy, and sample aliquoting. And, well, we did that in a space with biosafety level 2. The next step, and that's sort of where we are now, is that we want the laboratory to support 2 cohort studies that we are conducting in preparation for TB vaccine trials. And we want to be able to do solid and liquid mycobacterial cultures and molecular identification tests and improve the space to meet biosafety level 3 requirements. And then the third step after we've passed step 2 would be to be able to do culture-based drug susceptibility testing, initially for the study samples, but later also for other purposes. And then in the future, we hope that the laboratory could also support other studies and other projects. And then we wish to further define our role and relationship with the National TB Reference Laboratory. As I mentioned, acquire accreditation, or actually the research center would like all the laboratories to be accredited. Well, at the moment, it's only the laboratory of our HIV colleagues that has reached this stage. And also in the future, maybe be able to do more laboratory-based studies. So a bit more on our progress before I share with you our challenges. So we started sort of preparing for this around 2004 and had to first identify adequate space. And like I said, there was this nice laboratory building which had still space, but it had to be adjusted a bit. But the room had already controlled ventilation, but not negative pressure, but still controlled ventilation and controlled access and temperature. And already some furniture in it, so we had to do some minor adjustments. And so we procured some equipment and supplies already, class 2 by the biological safety cabinet, and an autoclave within the room. And then we had to recruit staff. Now that is quite an issue, because there are very few laboratorians around in the country that are experienced in TB laboratory work, other than the routine direct sedent smears that are being done at the public health facilities. So we chose to hire people that are experienced in doing research laboratory work and then train them further on for our purpose. And so over time, the staff has increased to 1 technologist who is in charge and 3 additional technologists and 2 technicians. And they started processing samples from 2006. Well, for this prevalence survey, we also had samples to be cultured, but we considered it not feasible to also already have a culture lab by that time. So we sent our samples to the Cambry Center for Respiratory Diseases Research in Nairobi, which is by courier, which is about 350 kilometers away on not so nice roads. Then step 2, and like I said, that's sort of where we are now. When Linda asked me to speak here a year ago, I thought we would be far beyond, but that's unfortunately not the case. But anyway, we have planned renovation of the existing space. And for those of you who like floor plans, you can study the picture at the right. So we want to change the airflow system to have negative pressure, change the floor and the layout of the laboratory, and include a second room that is next door and luckily still empty. And in the meantime, we've identified another temporary space in the same laboratory and received equipment, incubators, a midget 960 machine, and everything else that we basically need. And now we want to start training the staff and already start practicing the culture techniques. But in the meantime, some of the studies have started, and we are now sending some samples to be cultured to an, in the meantime, established TB laboratory in Eldered, which is only 150 kilometers away. It's already closer, but still not in our own place. So now, what are the challenges and the considerations we've had in this whole process? The first one is whether the what should actually be the biosafety level requirements of the laboratory. And I understand there's quite some debate about this, whether the lab, whether biosafety level 2 is enough or it should be 3, and there's also something called 2+. Well, like I said, I'm not the expert, but some considerations for us are that, well, our main goal is to do research, and especially we're preparing for phase 3 vaccine trials. So, I mean, certain standards should be met, but also in the research, in the trials, the safety of study participants is of the highest concern. But I think safety of the laboratory staff should be of equally concern. Mm-hmm. And then eventually we want to be able to do culture-based drug susceptibility testing, which for which reason we would like to have biosafety level 3. But yeah, the costs are an enormous challenge. But in the meantime, we really want to have this BSL-3 laboratory, so we have been working on trying to get the place renovated. And the issues that we encountered there is how to get the right advice on what to do and what to change. Because we figured there must be something that's sort of good enough. But depending on who you ask, you get also what I call Mercedes-Benz options, so things that are really far beyond what we really need and, of course, also very expensive. And then who can give the right advice? And, I mean, local expertise, there are no people walking around in Kisumu that can tell you how to change your laboratory into a biosafety level 3 laboratory. So you have to find people somewhere else. And one of the things we encountered is that you can hire certain people as consultants, and that's also necessary if you start working with contractors. But there may be a conflict of interest. You know, the same consultants who you hire to advise may also be the importance of, or the person importing certain equipment into the country, into Africa, and have an interest in certain equipment rather than others. And then another issue is that if you start talking about the laboratory with people who are experts in microbiology, then they do not necessarily know about construction. And we have, luckily, an engineer on site who knows a lot about construction but doesn't know anything about microbiology. And after you've dealt with that, then there are all sort of administrative procedures that then sometimes take you back to square one and have to do everything again. Also, the tendering process has been is an issue. It's bureaucratic, and it's difficult to get really transparent and proper quotations. And again, you need experts to prepare detailed bills of quantity so that you get what you want, but those may not always be completely free of conflicts of interest. Other considerations are the safety, which I already touched a bit on. So eventually we really would like to have a biosafety level 3 laboratory, but in the meantime we try to work as safe as possible. And recently we have appointed one technologist as a safety officer to really be the point person for safety issues. And the laboratory building as a whole has a general safety program. So the safety officers of each laboratory get regular updates and sort of training exercises and drills on what to do in case of spills or other situations. Fortunately, the center already has an incinerator on site, so we are able to incinerate the autoclaved waste directly on the compound. on quality control and quality assurance. From the beginning, we've worked with standard operating procedures and with increasing the projects that we're getting and increasing preparation towards vaccine trials. We get more and more advice on those, and those, I think, are getting better and better. And now one technology is the QA QC officer to specifically focus on quality issues. For the prevalence survey, we have we made an EQA program with our colleagues in Nairobi to recheck slides. Then maybe some people would expect our challenges on the actual culture techniques, but we haven't even reached there, and also that is not my expertise, so I leave that. But that is all still ahead of us, or the microbiology challenges. But in terms of the process, I think another thing what is difficult for anyone who wants to establish a laboratory like this in an area where there's no expertise is that there's not much expertise with procurement of equipment and supplies. And it really takes a lot of time for everyone involved to understand that you need products of reputable brands and from reputable vendors, and that the cheapest is not always what you want. Now, everything has to be imported into East Africa, so yeah, it's difficult to sort of find your way through the jungle there. I mean, not a jungle, an African jungle, but a jungle of products and things that are substandard quality and find the right things. That also satisfies sort of the wishes of the procurement department. I find our sort of donors and collaborators sometimes think that we make a reasonable budget, but really prices in East Africa, if you buy things locally, are very expensive compared to the US, Europe, or even also South Africa. But luckily from BD, we do now get reduced prices as part of this, the program for developing countries. And another real challenge is, of course, that all of this has to be done with donor funds, and also their priorities change, funding levels change. Some funds expire while you haven't completed your process of spending the money, and while you're doing your process, suddenly a donor changes their mind. And, well, so for instance, now we're ready to hit the go button on our renovations, but we have to renegotiate our funding. Another challenge and consideration is actually what the scope of this laboratory is for. And although I think there is the wish that national TB programs have sort of access to more culture laboratories. This is what I see in Kenya also, is that a lot of the laboratories that are being established are established for specific settings or specific programs or whatever. So also for us it is a question. At the moment we're still really busy to actually get it running. But the question is then, is it only to support research, but then it doesn't contribute so much to the needs of the national program? Should we do programmatic support, but only for special studies, also provide routine services, and then for culture, for DST, or for training, or for external quality assurance? So those are questions that have to be addressed in the future. And we've seen that our colleagues who work in HIV have really struggled with that and moved from a lot of programmatic support to back to only research, and that goes up and down. A concern raised here by some people is that if you want to do lab work for instance, epidemiological studies and vaccine trials, then actually the far majority of your samples that you collect are culture negative. And if you also do samples from suspects or for DST surveys, and you're not careful in your procedures and you have cross-contamination, then that may not affect so much your overall result for the DSTs or the suspects, but for your EPI work, 1% cross-contamination can easily double, triple, or quadruple your incidence or prevalence estimates, which is not what you want, of course. And then in our case, yeah, the center where we work, Cambry, is a research center, so that doesn't mean they can't do anything else, but it is, it's not an automatic that you can then also provide services to the public. And another thing to consider, we considered, is that with increasing QA, QC requirements for clinical trials, that sort of increases the cost. And then if you also want to do cultures for instance, programmatic purposes, then yeah, the same cost and the same standards will have to apply. So in conclusion, what are the lessons that we learned. Developing a TB culture lab really tailored to the local situation appears to be a very lengthy and complex process. And as I said already earlier, I thought that by this time we really would be far beyond the second step that I explained. But probably the fact that we aren't is already quite illustrative for the process and the efforts. And what I call a help desk for some sort of comprehensive advice would be useful. And what I mean is, like you have in or you can have for IT services, that you post your question somewhere, and if the first person at the help desk doesn't know the answer, then it gets escalated to the next level until your problem has been addressed. And I think for settings if we are to improve or to expand TB culture services in developing countries, then we talk about a lot of settings where there's really not much knowledge about how you build and create adequate TB culture laboratories, then some sort of central place or some place where people can ask for comprehensive advice would probably be useful. And then lastly, I think what I already mentioned, the importance to define the scope and the mandate of a laboratory. Because like I said, what you see is that laboratories develop for different purposes and different reasons and different projects, and how that all in the end is supposed to serve the overall needs of the TB control in the country, I think, is a question that needs to be addressed. And then lastly, I want to acknowledge very many people that in one way or the other advised us in this whole process. There are very many. If your name is not there and you think, hey, I also taught you something useful, then don't be offended. And of course, I want to thank the staff and the organizations that fund this. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Anja. Are there questions or comments on the challenges that have been faced in Kenya, or that I'm sure others are facing as well in other countries? Okay, thank you very much, Anja. Now, we've heard about the challenges of a TB culture lab, establishing that. Now we will hear about some of the progress that's been made and some of the challenges in establishing a national AFB microscopy network, strategic planning, training, and EQA, from Dr. Moses Jaloba from the National TB Laboratory in Uganda.
Okay. Thanks. Challenge number one. See? Click again. Okay. It's not happening.
If we first do this again and then we close it, no, it doesn't work anymore. Doesn't work.
Is there anyone that would like to comment about how they have overcome some of the challenges that Anja has brought up about receiving standardized information on building culture laboratories, where the information has come from, how to go about receiving information that you feel is not a conflict of interest from those that are advising you? No comments? John?
I can't say we have the solution now, but there was one of this is we had a technical consultation, CDC, with WHO on a number of programs in Atlanta just a month ago, and this came up over and over again, the idea that people need guidance. It's not universally understood or available. Where do you get the engineers and the architects? And this had to do with the air handling systems, issues of design, in addition to a number of others in terms of biosafety. One of the recommendations, and there further clarification on what are the biosafety levels, but also the need for recommendations related to specific methods. So it's not just what's the level, but looking at a risk-based approach, a risk assessment-based approach for each method in terms of looking at what are your practices. So, you know, we're still trying to get support that that is, in fact, a guidance issue for people around the world trying to construct and implement laboratories. So I would appreciate it others when in whatever forum that you keep repeating this issue because it's a challenge to get funding. People don't see this as an issue. So we're in the process of trying to get funding. We were heard it might be delayed a year, and we're trying to work around that, hopefully. So thanks.
Thank you, John. Evidently, they are working on the problem, but just bear with us.
Go on, yes. That's Pawan Angra from CDC. I'd like to just a general comment on what Anand's put in his presentation. I think in a lot of time, the problem arises in the very early planning of the system or any rollover of any training or any of these programs. Like the example of the smear microscopy you mentioned, like ultimately like they rolled over in the 700 microscopy center to made them. But they never thought in the planning stage that who will going to run those ones. So ultimately the people who are totally illiterate, who can't write their names and they do the cleaning work in those hospitals, they were made to prepare the smears. So how you can expect a good quality AFB smear microscopy there, where the person does not have a proper knowledge of how to process a sample. So like I think same situation will happen with the culture and DST ones. If you don't think ahead, who is going to do that thing? In those countries, the resources, human resources have to be developed first, so that in a continuous basis, you should be able to replenish all those people who leave those jobs. Thank you.
I'm in trouble.
You're going to have to speak very quickly, Moses. One of the issues that has been suggested here in John's description of developing guidelines is to go back to each country's responsibility for developing a national strategic plan for their laboratories that would include issues related to infrastructure and human resources and all of the issues that go into EQA, quality systems in the laboratory.
Waiting. I would Ed, maybe a different view from this one on the persons doing smear microscopy. And this has come up, and it's addressed in different areas. And there are issues of access, especially at the lowest level. Do you have trained technologists? And the reality is, does somebody have to have a 3 or 4 year laboratory technology degree to be taught how to smear sputum on a slide? The experience of a lot of people who have worked with this is that if they work under supervision, that their work is checked, they don't have to have a college degree to necessarily do that. I know it's a very divisive issue in terms of, you know, making sure that we raise laboratory standards, but I know ones, Armand and others who have worked in many of these low-resource countries where you're trying to decentralize the test, there's actually a lot of success of working with people if their work is monitored in getting them to do a good job. In fact, sometimes you will find the highly trained people are extremely bored and may not be motivated to do that job. So I know it's not an easy one. We all want to raise up the profession, but there's a question of can people actually be trained to do the steps on the test. So it's
thanks. And thanks for bearing with us. So let me, my topic is establishing a national FB microscopy network, strategic planning, training, and HUA. So my other presenters have talked about microscopy, but still want to remind you that microscopy diagnoses the most infectious TB, the smear positive, and is still important in monitoring progress of treatment. Microscopy still have good advantages and disadvantages. It is a rapid test. It's so far well distributed. Cheap in terms of recurrent cost. The reagents don't cost that much. And still very specific, especially in high burden countries. Still has its disadvantages of being labor intensive. It's a subjective test. You need to be experienced. I need a more elaborate setup. You need the unit, you need reagent. It's not like a single strip. And suffers of low sensitivities in certain settings. But it still has had its impact. In the past, this test has been used to control TB in many countries. Many countries have achieved success using this tool. And even now, it still remains the main tool in TB diagnostic in the high burden countries. It's the one available. And when you look in the future, if you really have a good microscopy network, this can be used to introduce other tests. So for that matter, there is still stronger need for us to strengthen these microscopy networks. And this is an example of a health structure, and you have a TB network, and it relates to other things. Most of the networks are integrated in the health structures. This is the Uganda network. You have the National TB Reference Laboratory and the Central Public Health Laboratory and the intermediate laboratories. You have public sector, non-governmental, and private setups. And all of these participate in microscopy. And to summarize the major divisions, you have the National TB Reference Laboratory and Central Public Health Laboratory. These are the technical head of the network. Note they are really technical. They are not administrative. And these guide the network. Then you have an intermediate level, which works as a liaison between the head and the periphery labs. This intermediate level is really needed if you are to sustain the network. Otherwise, if it is weak, then the National Reference Laboratory cannot work directly with the periphery labs. It cannot sustain the job. And of course, the periphery labs are the ultimate target of the network activities. It's where the real diagnosis takes place. In strategic planning, if you are to strategically plan for this network, you need to strengthen the head, the National TB Reference Laboratory. The network is going to be as good as the head. If the head is weak, that's the best you are going to get. So the head needs to be the model for the network to set standards as the point of reference. The head needs to plan for the network to adapt to different situations. Then it needs to guide the network, issues the standards, manuals, has to support the network in terms of material, provide technical support, needs to advocate for the network, both locally and internationally. The people have problem, you have to come up. And the head is responsible to monitor the network. So if the head is weak, again, all these things will not work well. So in order really to do good planning for the network, you need information. And the information is power. This information will show the defects, the strength, and the gaps. And so the information is needed about the diagnostic units in the network, their number and distribution, their capacity. You need information about the human resource and their capacity in the network. And the human resource, both technical and non-technical, are key, because or even the people who do not work in the lab, as you know, they are very relevant. You need their number and qualification. You need to know their training needs. You need the equipment number and functionality. You need the supplies, their quality and quantity, the distribution system, the finances. You need to know your current and future needs in order to do good budgeting. And you need to know where you will get the funding. Otherwise, things will be tough. And then the technical issues, you need to be aware what is being done in the network. And once you have the right information, you set the right direction. That right information will lead you to having good objectives when you are drawing your strategic plan and work plans, activities, and tasks. And it will help you actually write good proposals, both local and international, to advocate for good funding. And you can easily talk well about the network if you have information, and coordination is easier, allows good monitoring. If you have information, you know your baseline, and you know the trend where you are going. Otherwise, if you really don't have good information, the things will be haphazard. And with good information, you do proper intervention. Your recommendations and actions will be targeted, or else you will be misguided. And the information, therefore, need to be well collected, kept, analyzed, and interpreted. For that to happen, you must have a good manager to collect good information, good data personnel, and good tools and database. So you need to have a good management information system to do good planning. And we talk about training. Training is important to equip the network with the right knowledge and ensures standardization, that all you're on the same page, and instills confidence and motivation. Once the people are trained and they are knowledgeable, they are more confident and motivated to do the work. And the training should target the schools in terms of curriculum, but even the workers may get new training if there is new techniques out there, new knowledge, or be refreshed in what they are doing. And in order to plan this training, you need to consider the suitable trainees, their qualification and position. You really need to train the people who do the work. Many times you do cut out training and you train the wrong people. And you need to keep the right content. This should be simple, relevant, and focused. It should be in appropriate format. For new trainees, probably emphasize basics. But for refresher training, 75% of this should be demonstration and troubleshooting, known to repeat a lot. And maintain a training database. You should know who is trained and where they are located. This is an example of a training database we use in Uganda. So you could easily know the number of people you train, and this can give you further where they are located and their qualification and their setups. This is the following year. So what is effective training? In our experience, this classroom training is good but has minimal impact. The technologists know it is another training. They come, and sometimes it's the way of earning allowances. But I think the more effective training is the one which is a sustained on-job training with follow-up. The technicians show this as really some seriousness and motivates when they see you coming again, they know you care. and it adapts training to specific needs. And the follow-ups in the trainings can be done by the intermediate labs, and in addition to people from the central labs when they visit on site. And how many times should you visit and follow up? In our experience, this is an ongoing process, and you shouldn't give up until things are okay. In the case of Kampala, we did a small operational research. After training in class, on the first visit, we only found that 40% had implemented what we talked about in class. Even after we told them that we'll be coming back after 2 weeks, we only added another 20%. We went back again after 2 weeks. Only when, even up to the fourth visit, we didn't achieve 100%. So if we had left it at this point, I think soon things would have deteriorated back. So a lot of money is wasted in classroom training, and this is really not very effective. I will briefly end with external quality assurance. This is part of quality assurance, and quality assurance has three components: the quality control, which is done within the lab, HUA, which is from out, and the quality improvement is the overall goal for quality assurance. In turn, external quality assurance program has three components: on-site supervision, blinded week checking, and panoramic testing. The final aim of this is to have reliable FB microscopy. But the intermediate aim is to detect and solve problems as you go along, and it provides continuous motivation and education. It's not for correction of clinical management or individual evaluation or comparisons of those who participate. So there are many steps if you successfully initiate EQA. Initially, you need the funds. This is a costly endeavor. You will not succeed without that. And you need to sensitize the program. You equip the labs, and equipping is not that expensive, but at least you need these people to have enough things to do the microscopy, or else your HUA will not measure anything. And you need to conduct follow-up visits. I think I've emphasized that. Refresher training is necessary. Many times these people are forgotten. So if you don't refresh or train, you don't expect to improve. Collect the slides and take them to controllers, and compile and send feedback reports. Without feedback reports, soon people lose motivation. And ensure recommendations are implemented. That is the overall aim. If you only identify problems and you say there are problems and you don't follow up to correct them, then the overall aim is lost. There are success tips for external quality assurance. Expand gradually. Don't storm the whole country. Just learn lessons and keep improving. And again, I've talked about information. Have a good management information system. And have good communication with the units. This is one of HUA data from Uganda. And as you can see, you can easily monitor the units, the zones. You can color code them, and you can see trends from year to year. So you can easily know how each individual unit is performing. So this is color coded, and it shows you units. The red ones are the badly off, the orange fair, and the colorless are, you say, okay. So you can target your supervision instead of just visiting everybody. These are feedback reports. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Moses. Are there questions or comments right now? Yes, could you step to the microphone, please?
Well, it was a very good presentation. It almost seemed like Jack and Jill. Because very few words were used, but it was very effective. Just to talk on the same lines, he showed some very nice monitoring evaluation data. I want to narrate an experience from India. I was working with Anand Date few years back in India in the TB program. Now I'm in Papua New Guinea. I just analyzed a very simple data on initial defaulters for a province called Gujarat. And I was surprised, and then, of course, the central TB division also surprised, that 20% of the people sputum positive detected in the microscopy centers were initial defaulters. When people came to know that, very simple actions could lead to a jump in the detection by 10% units. So very simple things can also make a difference. That's what I'm doing.
Thank you. Any other comments? Yes? Thank you. Please identify yourself.
Russell Dacken from the Liverpool School of Tropical Medicine. I was just intrigued. Very good to see so much supervision going on. How many people does this take for how many labs?
How many people does for how many?
For the supervision, because I'm always intrigued. Countries often assign very few individuals to supervise laboratories.
I think it really is very experienced. I think that is the whole problem. We do have at the national TB reference laboratory, we have divided the country into 9 zones, as you could see, and we have a technician dedicated to 2 zones as a full-time supervision job. In addition, we also involve the intermediate, which is the region and the districts, in the supervision. But this is the weakest point. They get excited in the beginning, but then they lose motivations down the road, and that we really need to figure out how to sustain. So far, only 50% of the intermediate is still involved. So I hope I have answered your question. But it needed to expand the capacity of the National Reference Laboratory to hire more people to do this.
Yeah, absolutely answer my question. Okay.
Yes.
Alexei Karabitsyn, Tajikistan. Thank you very much for a very good presentation. It was very well presented. After 4 trainings, 98% of success, things were okay. Question, they were trained the same people 4 times, or they were selected people who were not training before and trained each second time? Thank you.
Okay. So I think I didn't make the point clear. So what happened is that you identify the people and you bring them in class and you train them, and then you say, so go back, keep the slides according to the register in the slide boxes and do a good job, staying well. So then after 2 weeks, you visit all the people as a follow-up to see whether they did what you had taught in class. So that is the sequence, in that as you visit them, you think they go excited, they will implement. Most of them say, well, it was a good training, and they just drop the notes and they just continue as usual. So after you go, we only found 40% really did some change. But those we didn't do, we said we are coming back in 2 weeks. Even that didn't change some. So that is the sequence of events. Emphasizing that classroom training is not enough.
Great. Thank you very much, Moses. Now, because we have some time, so we are going to follow up with our last speaker and then have time for discussion at the end. To wrap up from the perspective of approaches for integrating the national systems for TB labs and programs in high-burden countries is Dr. Max Salfinger. He's currently the director of the TB labs in this, or the laboratory system in the state of Florida.
Good afternoon, everybody. It was a real difficult task for me to prepare for this lecture. And don't expect to have a 1, 2, 3, 4 prescription how to integrate the TB laboratories in a national TB program in a high burden country. But I hope that I can give you some ideas which go beyond just a TB laboratory and a national TB program. We, even in the laboratory, need to focus what we are actually working for. And this, with Mahatma Gandhi, it's health, which is real wealth and not pieces of silver and gold. In the public sector, usually we cannot pay average or decent salaries. So we need to encourage that there are other values than just money. Although money is needed. My outline, first I would like to talk a little bit systems thinking, then a TB lab, infectious disease lab, public health lab perspective, because that's a gradient we need to see as well and not just stick to the TB laboratory. Then we need to acknowledge that not a single laboratory, wherever it is the same. And so with other words, you can learn other people's lessons, but you may still learn your own lesson, whatever you do. Lastly, then TB lab versus TB program in this context, and then again a higher level beyond TB program with a communicable disease control. And as usual, we need to change some attitudes, some beliefs, and so on. So I start with the systems thinking and promoting favorable outcomes of TB patients. The smiley face here is actually smiling. But at one point, this person has a responsibility to maintain health. And then as we move on to the right, the patient needs to be educated to recognize symptoms. For a TB, it's relatively easy. 3 weeks of unexplained cough, you see a doctor. If you have a fever and cough, you go now. But that doesn't mean actually the patient seeks care. And so this is also built in our delays, and now the second partner, the community, needs to guarantee to actually have access to a care. And oftentimes, this is not available. So here as a community, we are responsible again to make sure that everybody, regardless where he or she is, has access to care. Then ultimately the patient shows up, and then the healthcare provider here, the physician, can be a nurse, being suspicious, ordering correct tests. We heard earlier on that WHO TDR section had to publish a report that 19 serological assays are garbage, and they are still used. So this is what I mean with ordering correct tests and then ultimately prescribing adequate regimen based on these laboratory results. And then comes the public health as the last partner, overseeing medical care and assuring therapy completion. And the smiley face is still smiley and is not dead. But there are other turnaround times issue where the laboratory is involved to a certain degree, and this is some data from Peru. Smear microscopy, from smear microscopy request to microscopy result, a range 0 to 8 days is not too bad. But later on, the MTB culture, from the time the smear result was reported to the time the culture result is received at the health establishment, is already a 54. And the range, I don't know how they manage zero here, but at least the upper range, 151 days. And something has to do with the laboratory, but also outside of the laboratory issues. Then it goes on with drug susceptibility testing. You add another 95 days as a median or six between 320. And then even when the patient evaluation, the result is at the healthcare facility, it may take another 5 weeks in the medium to order the patient back. So these are issues which we need to keep in mind when we are focusing on laboratory improvement and say we need to be the magician. We need to pull this rabbit out of the hat now. Then we need to see what did we lose already earlier on and what are we going to lose delay in times later on, which is also part of the entire circle. Integrated service delivery, old-fashioned ATM machine, automated teller machine, and this is where usually some people get their cash. But for us, it certainly aids, it's TB and malaria. But we don't need to stop already there. I know Global Fund and so on, they funnel now at least TB, AIDS and malaria together, but the TB laboratory is still the TB laboratory. If we want to have any synergies, we need to branch out. And there is more to than just the ATM, and that means, for instance, newborn screening. Yes, in some developed resource rich countries, they test 30, 40 markers. But in many other countries, they are starting to test as well. Sickle cell, PKU, and so on, even five other disorders. But ultimately, I am pretty sure, and this is why I bring this aspect, the mass tandem mass spectrometry used in newborn screening could theoretically be used when FIND is talking about the volatile organic component at the health post when you exhale, because there they most likely need also a mass spectrometry. So with other words, even newborn screening is far away from a TB laboratory perspective, but if you pull it within the public health domain, then it could be just the laboratory next door. In the United States, the Association of Public Health Laboratories, they developed 6 years ago a guidance document about the, together with the CDC, guidance document about the core function of a state public health laboratory. And this can be for 1 million people, or like in Florida, for 18 million people. So this is what we use as our guidance. Disease prevention, control, and surveillance. Integrated data management. Thank you, Moses, to ring this message home, how important it is. Reference specialized testing, environmental health and protection, even we focus on the communicable on the disease side, in many areas there is an environmental catastrophe going on, which is also a public health concern. And again, some of the instruments can be used in both sides. And their food safety, I don't have to say much, recent with the contaminated milk products coming out of China. Laboratory improvement regulation policy development. The laboratory needs to be part with the regulation. If regulators allow 19 serological tests, which an expert panel regard as garbage, to be sold, then obviously these regulators don't understand their business. Emergency response, public health-related research, training and education, and their partnerships and their communication. I'm pretty sure you fully agree with this agenda, with these 10 core functions. So when you look at any type of development, use some of these roadblocks to build up in addition just to the TB laboratory, TB program, tunnel vision. TB laboratory is not the same here, one of our complex here in Jacksonville, Florida, 200 people. We do newborn screening, environmental chemistry. But we started 100 years early in this old building, which is actually here, where the TB control program, disease control program, environmental, the health secretary, they were all under one roof. And guess what? The laboratory was in the cellar. So this is, at least one was together now. The program site is in Tallahassee, the capital, 200 miles away from Jacksonville, but we still have all these buildings there to be the more or less reference laboratory for the state. There are some for other laboratories out there. But we also heard already from Kenya, and Linda provided these photos. When we have resource-poor countries or high-burden countries, we should not think this is always a tent in the Amazon and you need to have solar power or sunlight to do anything. So there again is a gradient of a lot of things already available, and we need to take advantage of that. And it's certainly not just a kitchen sink with a staining rack and a microscope. But in all these various institutions, there is a boss, there is a supervisor, and somebody is in charge. And this is more or less what I think, what my duty is in the state of Florida, ensuring that staff can do their jobs. I'm not at the bench any longer. That's why I like to work very hard, so they get what they need. That means enough qualified staff, enough funds. Don't think the diamonds and the honey and the gold is coming raining from the sky in the United States. No way. We have to fight for the same type of money within our system as people in sub-Saharan Africa or wherever. Enough laboratory space, ensuring a safe workplace, ensuring current diagnostic and technology, providing an environment for personal growth, planning for the future, interacting with other programs, advising chief of staff, deputy secretaries, more or less indirectly the governor, and actively participating in local, state, national, and international organizations, sharing best practices. When we share, this doesn't cost any dime of consultant fees. But there is something else in the laboratory we need to realize, like a biosafety cabinet, requires maintenance, 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 and if there is complacency, this is what happens. Happened in Minnesota last year, August 2007. The inspection reports were bad, but no money to fix them. So if your BSC is not certified, you may not recognize that you are sitting on a time bomb. External quality control, this is an assessment I was able to do in Kosovo just when the war stopped at that time, and we were using New York State proficiency testing slides, so they were well validated, and these seven laboratories, five smear microscopy and two culture laboratories, had just a 68 passing score, and then soon after they increased to 100%. Since they are only seven laboratories, it's easy to maintain 100%, but compared to the United States, there is never 100% from all the laboratories. So they were very proud that actually in Kosovo they did a better job than back home in my country. But there is also something we need to do even when you don't have resources. That means staff celebration. Whatever you can celebrate, please celebrate here our hero, Dan O'Keefe, 53 years with the Public Health Laboratory in New York, more than 50 years of them in the TB laboratory. He started off with guinea pig inoculation and ultimately left when molecular drug resistance is done. He has seen the entire gamut, and here you see our facilitator, Linda. Suheyla was a visiting scientist from Turkey, Oleg a visiting scientist from Kazakhstan. Now on the program side, still the professional development, if you share these activities, it may be cheaper for you than if you have to sign up only for yourself. If you team up with the program, they also need supervisory training. So a supervisory training for the lab or for the program, you can combine that. Diagnostic algorithm. It's really important that we don't treat every specimen the same way. I would even argue this is a waste of resources. We have to make differences. That's why we need to work together with the program to come up with these diagnostic algorithms, implementation of new assays, logistics, commodities management, facility and equipment maintenance, policy development. We know that we all need to do that, but we shouldn't forget it. They are important. This is Gene Lindemann. In 1960, 3 years early actually, he was the co-discoverer of interferon, but he also, as a young postdoc, wrote a book about a laboratory in a hospital, and he mentioned this. Every test performed without a strict indication is not only spinning the wheels, it also means that the quality of a more meaningful test is jeopardized. If you waste your money with nonsense testing, you don't have enough money. And you cannot do what you actually need to do. And so this brings me to something else. We barely talk about errors and error prevention. Overuse of a test, underuse of a test, and certainly misuse of a test. These are all considered errors. And we need to bring in a system which prevents them of happening. Now, moving, since a lot of people have access to genotyping data, this is from New York City. You see the bars confirmed, false positive, TB culture in New York City, 2001, 2, 3, and 4. So the trend at least goes downhill. So what we did actually makes a reaction, improves overall, but the important thing is the light blue bar here on the very right is when a healthcare provider recognized something is fishy. This is not possible that the patient has a positive culture. So a very small percentage of the healthcare provider recognized, then BTBC is the Bureau of TB Control. So other people in TB Control recognized, this is the second from right, and then DNA is, since we had universal genotyping, is when the genotyping lab spotted control stains coming up because there is a very characteristic spoligotyping pattern, or other links which didn't make sense. And then another option was the single positive culture. When we talk about improvement and so on, we do not include this new technology in the assessment of the overall quality, and the laboratory cannot do it alone. You need to work together with your program. Then in terms of regulation, in terms of approving, recommending new assays, I don't know how well you, yeah, actually you can read. So from 1980 to 1996, the U.S. market penetration for the old BACTEC 460 TB, and you recognize until 92 around, when you leave total free market and the good guys in the laboratory are implementing whatever they can, it took them 12 years to come up with 50% of the market penetration. And as soon as CDC published its recommendation that liquid medium and faster turnaround times are needed in order to cope with the drug-resistant epidemic in the United States, then it took just another few years to add 50%. So it is important that regulatory authorities are not only saying this is not good of a test, but also on the positive side. And then, as I mentioned, not every specimen is equal, or you could say no to one size fits all. With the acid fast bacilli positive, you still should treat this as a priority because it's more infectious than the smear negative case. HIV positive. We still look at HIV positives only that the smear sensitivity is lousy, but we forget the fact that some of the HIV positive have blood culture specimen positive before the smear becomes positive of the sputum. So where is the policy that in the HIV that we actually are looking also for blood cultures, because the sensitivity there, you would diagnose TB much earlier than waiting for your sputum result. No TB laboratory has a blood culture system. So that's why you need to team up. When you deal with HIV positive, with an infectious disease laboratory who may have this for inpatient for the hospital when they have septicemia. And yes, TB is culturable in the HIV positive out of the blood. And certainly, if there is any evidence of drug-resistant MDR, XDR, I think this needs to be done with the fastest, with the highest priority. So this is what we offer currently in my laboratory in Jacksonville: acid fast microscopy, one day turnaround time, nucleic acid amplification, since in the southeast of the United States, not every smear positive is actually tuberculosis, only about 50%. So we need to know among the smear positive newly diagnosed if it's really TB or non-tuberculous mycobacteria. and now the MDR screen 2 days, but here it's not yet universal, but the TV-Doc network will approve. So if there is a public health importance in a particular case, then they can order this and we run it twice a week. Gross detection up to 6 weeks. When you have a culture, TB versus NTM, 1 day susceptibility testing, 1 to 2 weeks. Our laboratory runs 7 days a week. Some people feel that's stunning for a governmental agency, but we do it. Overnight specimen submission preferred. If a provider has an urgency, then this is how he can commit to the urgency that the specimen comes also faster to your laboratory. And then Moses already talked about the electronic lab reporting. It's very important. In this particular case, we report electronically to TB control, but also to the provider. And so that means mail and fax is not needed any longer. But just a couple of weeks ago, we rolled out electronic lab ordering. So we don't have to key in all the data. The provider does that when he, she orders, in a way, the laboratory. And this is with all our 67 county health department in Florida. Has the other advantage when the provider keys in the demographics. They know the name of the patient and. When you get something handwritten on the other end in the laboratory, how many times we cannot read what we get? And we call it Triple F, Florida Fast Track. But that means, yes, in certain circumstances, we are even willing to come in at night or do a MDR screen even on the weekend to pull this rabbit out of the hat if TB control is really persistent that it's important. Triage using established diagnostic algorithm. This is adapted from FIND, the various levels. But we need to be cognizant that in this setting, yes, 60% when the patients go, they actually don't have yet an AFB testing. But I would challenge each of you to think about who actually goes one step higher. Is that equal opportunity? Or is it the rich person? Or is it the educated person? When actually whoever should go higher up should go higher up to the health center referral laboratory, and then 5% end up at the national reference laboratory. So if this is the case that only 5% end up, don't overburden the national reference laboratory with not important samples. They don't need to be the laboratory who do hundreds of thousands of a specimen when they indeed have to deal with maybe the HIV because they are the fastest, or in terms of drug resistant, then they can do also a faster assay to determine their drug resistance. And don't bog them down to be just a better referral laboratory in the district. I'm allowed to dream a little bit, and this is what I do, looking to the stars. But this is what I think we need to go for. Coming from Florida with a launching pad, and Kazakhstan has, and I think Canada, and a few others. So we are privileged, but we cannot continue in a way with the pace how we improve. We cannot go from smear to better smear. This would be like the base camp of the Himalaya. And then you take the first mountain, and then you think you are already at the Himalaya, but you are just front range with your culture And then the next range, when you are on the top, you see an X mountain, and it is for a drug resistant. And in terms of quality control and so on, you need genotyping, and then at the sudden you recognize, I still don't see the Mount Everest. Because it's too long, it goes too slow, and we need to triage patients and not necessarily specimen, and this requires leadership. And the cartoon says it all. Lead, don't follow. What should be hot? This is just a geyser, obviously hot water. And patient-oriented, we shouldn't still focus on sample-oriented when we do business in the laboratory. And this, in addition, requires interaction with the program. If you don't get the information, then you don't know. But this is how you could save some resources. Then certainly to aim at the shortest turnaround time possible, molecular assays is now a real must. And electronic reporting saves an awful lot of time for the laboratory. So even usually we think technician reading the smear and electronic reporting is so far away, I bring another metaphor back to you and could easily ask, who has a cellular phone? Probably all of us have a cellular phone, regardless where you work. Even in the jungle, they have cellular phones. Or even the beggar on Champs-Élysées has a cellular phone. So with other words, when Alexander Bell, 1876, invented the telephone, this was very close when Robert Koch, in a way, discovered AFB smear microscopy. And then you have the rotary phone, old-fashioned. This would be your Löwenstein-Jensen. And then you have the touch-tone phone, and this is your breast culture. Nobody uses a touch-tone phone any longer. It's cellular phone. It's transformed in something more than a phone. It's now not even called cellular phone. It's the iPhone. So that you can do much more with a cellular phone, from GPS, email, whatever you wish, similar to the molecular assays. So we need change. And talking about change, there are four basic principles we as human beings need to overcome. When I talk to you, I'm not sure if you heard me. If you actually heard me, I don't know if you understood me. And this is the most difficult thing. Even if you understood, the hardest is to implement. If you are convinced a new assay needs to be implemented, Antje told us how difficult it is to go the myriad of steps to implement something new. But even if it's implemented, guess what? It's not retained. After a while, we heard it from Armand that he visits several laboratories. They have Florence microscope. And they are under the desk, not used collecting dust. So these are very important principles. You can use them in the TB laboratory, in church, in your university, wherever you are. They are important. But this is what we are all here for, the never give up. Fortunately, the lab and the program are the stork. Are the frog. And this is what we have to do, never give up fighting tuberculosis and fighting poverty. If we fix poverty, TB is just icing on the cake. But since we allow poverty, TB will be still with us. And then, ultimately, and this is my last one, standing up for peace on earth. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Dr. Selfinger, for a very animated and motivated presentation. Are there any questions to Dr. Selfinger? Can I ask or just make a statement before anybody else does? The regulatory aspects, and you were referring to the serological test, is not because of regulators not knowing what they're doing in Africa. It is because there are none. For diagnostics, we don't have any regulations or regulatory bodies. So
Max's extremely dynamic speech motivates me to stand up and make a few very simple comments. But first, I'd like to congratulate, I'm Richard Bumgarner. Congratulate all of the presenters. I think this is just so rewarding to hear such a well-structured talk about training, as Moses gave, and as we heard also Dr. Date from India mention these things. But what I take away from Max's talk, and all of them collectively, how to move faster, that spaceship, and how to get the honey and the milk and the money to rain down. And my experience has been wherever I see really good TB control programs, it's a combination of the laboratory services and the program working together and talking together. And that's one thing that I know Tom Frieden did so well in India, and every place where people just take the simple idea of, you know, the medical grand round and set it up so that once every 90 days or so, whatever timing is convenient, the program people are sharing the results in their registry with the laboratory people in their registry so that the laboratory workers get to see some of the program managers and they get to hear from the program managers. My laboratory work resulted in so many cases found, so many cases under control, being successfully converted from intensive phase onto continuation phase with bacteriological proof, not just a promise that the patient took all the drugs and therefore progresses off the intensive phase, and most importantly, how many cures are really documented with bacteriological proof. By sharing between the two, whenever it happens, and I know it happens at many good places in India, it happens in places in Central Asia, there becomes that supportive communication where the laboratory worker feels valued, even though his salary has not gone up, and is motivated to do a much better job, and where the physician or the caregiver is able to then talk more eloquently to whom? Those who control the politics and the money. And I have seen time after time where the TB program director at a Kabupaten level or a rayon level or oblast level is able to pull the local mayor or the Bupati in and point to what the laboratory has done, what the treatment results have been, and say what a great use this has been of your money for salaries, for equipment purchases. Look at the results we're achieving. It doesn't take long before the donors hear about this, and that's what you want. You want the donors to be supportive for all the needs that you identified, and it also builds on the retention. When the people you've trained in the laboratory course go home, of course they don't retain everything, and 2 months later practices fade away. But if you have this process of seeing the results of their work validated by the program management staff and they share together this thinking, it creates that extra retention. And since all politics are local, every time you can show success with TB, which is a very local disease, people know who has TB in the community, every time you can show that success, you build the chances of the money, the milk, and the honey raining down, as Max has said, and we can go faster. These same things will be true as you move to the molecular, the rapid tests, the culture, and so forth. So I just commend you all. I think it's been a very, very positive session. Thank you.
Thank you.
In terms of the collaboration laboratory and TB control or national TB control program, it's really important whenever the TB control program has a meeting, a symposium, or even when they call in for a quarterly meeting with their regional managers and dealing about surveillance, make sure that somebody from the laboratory is there to explain what the laboratory does. Because when they have a better understanding, and guess what? It wouldn't have been possible that WHO, These are not laboratorians. Obviously, WHO got educated very quickly in order to endorse the latest memorandum about the molecular drug resistance gene. If they wouldn't have been educated, we probably still would wait 5-10 years. And so it's really important that laboratorians do the step towards the TB control. Don't wait until you're invited. Just show up where the TB controller is and introduce yourself and tell that person that you are willing to work together, and whenever there is something you need to know about the laboratory, contact us. We will have all this time, because when he, she knows, more people know, and so you have already an army of ambassadors on your laboratory behalf. In terms of the regulatory, I didn't mean this just for Africa or South Africa. I can tell you the same story in the United States with Lyme disease. Yes, we have regulatory agency, and they sign off on crap assays when they actually know exactly the laboratory organization and the professional organization say it's worthless, and they still, for whatever reason, approve it. So there are some undercurrent going on, which we fortunately don't control, but when you are in the laboratory, it's always good to stick to the science and not to the politics.
Agreed. Next.
I guess that's me again. Sorry, Russell Dacken again from the Liverpool School. I'd just like to highlight what Max said about an integrated laboratory approach. We all complain about the human resource crisis, as Moses was saying, about supervision. You know, there's a shortage of people out there. There's a shortage of money out there. So I agree with that it's time for a change. It's time to look beyond just TB control. Because at the periphery, people are doing a number of tests, but they're not being supervised equally, and the control and the quality control is not there for many. I have to say, apologies if there's colleagues in malaria here, but it's way behind TB as regards quality assurance, so we need to take that step and that leadership, I think, both at the local level, and I know there's some GLI members here as well, at the global level as well, to make sure we bring people together. So that's just a comment on that. So.
Thank you. Anybody else?
Good afternoon. My name is Marlene Kai. I work for the Dutch Ministry of Health. Would it be possible for you to elaborate a little bit on the role of supranational reference labs and how you see them in the global TB control, and if how you perceive the role of a supranational reference lab as an addition to the laboratory systems in the countries where they don't have a national reference lab?
I'm more than willing to share my opinion, but it's just my opinion.
Please.
I am not a WHO official, but I think what's going on with the supranational laboratory is the centerpiece, or just as many things we don't pay attention. You cannot expect that supranational laboratories can do a good job if they don't receive a single dime for doing their job. It's just not working any longer. In the hospitals, it's not the nurses, the sister with God's hourly wages, meaning free of charge, is doing the work. No, they are salarized, and for these supranational laboratory, we need to come up with funding for them. If we provide funding, we can also hold them accountable for more than what is currently done. Right now, they do the surveillance. Every few years, they send 20 strains, which they receive from Armand, the WHO center for the surveillance. And then they send this out to their district laboratories when they actually do culture and susceptibilities. But more or less, there it stops. When we would like to have them utilized in the entire training and quality assurance aspect. But you cannot expect that the laboratory has the capability to spend their own dollars for international work. It just doesn't work any longer. In the past, maybe, and we were helpful for every in-kind donation, but now with rollout of culture and molecular assays, there has to be a systematic approach, and there have to be more, and not just on a in-kind voluntary basis. And some of these supranational laboratories, when you see some of the results, they actually don't perform the best either. So that's then another aspect. So since there is no stick and the carrot approach, we don't pay them, therefore we cannot use the stick and ask them to improve themselves. I'm talking here about a very, very minority, but it still happens because the system is not set up. I would wish that we actually could have real money and to come up with a description and help them then accountable over the years, and when they have trainings done with certain laboratories where they build up a long-time relationship, that ultimately we should be able to see, in a way, the impact. But right now, some may go on an annual basis to these laboratories in other countries. Some may go every 3-4 years. This is not how to maintain, in a way, this relationship. And we certainly cannot do this any longer as a gratis, free, in kind.
Thank you very much.
Can I ask why you asked that question?
In Holland, our national public health laboratorium is a supranational reference lab for a few countries. As a policy officer in the Dutch Ministry of Health, I'm currently looking into methods where maybe our government could do some more in tuberculosis support in specific areas. Mm-hmm. I can imagine that with the expertise which we have in the country, that would be the way, also listening this afternoon, mm-hmm. that we could do more in sharing that expertise. I do share a little bit the view which you are just presenting now, that if you set up a system with supranational reference labs, it would be good if it is an accountable system, it would be good if it's a funded system, mm-hmm. and if it is something which is more sustainable over a longer period of time. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because but I don't have a strong opinion on it yet. It's still...
No, I accept what you're saying, because in Africa there are only two currently. A third in East Africa is under discussion. So, yeah, and if you look at the burden of disease, there's this very big... step that needs to be crossed.
Yes, I was more looking for the discussion to see if we think that this supranational reference labs is indeed the way forward, or that we would think that it's better to invest in national reference labs instead of focusing on supranational reference labs.
Yeah.
I'm not sure.
I have an opinion, but that's good.
I think within WHO they are actually working on a system-wide approach and to cover, in a way, the entire globe. John, do you want to elaborate on
that? Yes, if I could add to that, the WHO's top TB department is putting together really a broader plan that looks for systematic funding for the Supranational Reference Lab Network. There are a few countries that support their own laboratory, and that's the other possibility. You could at least look within the plan of how you would support your own laboratory. I think they're looking more for systematic support across the whole network. And historically, there has been variation. There are some laboratories that do the minimum of assuring the quality of the drug resistance surveillance. That was the initial requirements of the network. There's others that go much farther in terms of actually working with the country on their entire laboratory network. And it could be that not every supranational lab, seeing where they're located, has all the skills and capacity to work with low-income countries in terms of building their network, and that may take other partners. But I think the important thing is there is a more comprehensive plan being put in place, and hopefully that would be the place to look for trying to get those appropriate resources to do that. I do think we have to recognize that there has been a significant effort by all of these laboratories to devote themselves. A lot of this is people trying to find funding wherever they can because they believe strongly in what they're doing. So it has been an amazing contribution given the resources devoted to date. So
I agree with that. Anybody else?
Of course.
Akos Shomashkevi. If, as a member of the audience, I try to extract to myself the most important take-home messages that I heard today, starting with Dr. Salfinger's presentation, we heard that the TB laboratories are not the same. The specimens are not the same. Most importantly, the patients are not the same. We heard from Moses how important are conventional methods to set a good functioning service, EQA services, but they are not enough. And sometimes even simple techniques are out of the reach for countries with such a vast territory like Uganda or many other similar countries. And we also saw a summary chart in Anand's presentation. What should be the way forward as regards to microscopy and culture? How much money would that involve? How much time would that involve? And this is a recent summary chart. And I think we have to listen and we have to be heard, as I learned it today, that it's really time to change this recent summary chart and find other pathways and not to walk this 10, 15 years road that was very challenging, even for non-resource-poor countries. And in many non-resource-poor countries, they are not yet there with proper biosafety things, and we could make a list. So I think it would be really important to find the new ways, not necessarily to walk the same old road everywhere and all the time, taking into consideration that we have novel methods and we have to find the best way, because these novel methods actually are there for 10 years now. We know that. So the challenge is to find the best way to be used and the other roads to make a shortcut.
Mm-hmm. With greater emphasis on algorithm development, I presume. Mm. Mm. Anybody else? Ladies and gentlemen, are you exhausted? It is. You have another 10 minutes, but we won't hold you against your will. So if I may just thank the presenters, they all did a fantastic job here. We appreciate it. Thank you.